Now, you're at Founders FAQ. Answers to all the possible questions of a founder.
AI and kind of a new wave of enterprise software companies are going to become kind of AI native to drive efficiencies across, again, all areas, whether it's legal, risk management, compliance, you know, underwriting, vendor onboarding. Again, I think there's a ton of workflows that are very kind of human capital intensive that have the potential for AI to have a huge impact. And maybe that is kind of a heuristic, you know, areas where, you know, there is a ton of kind of human capital intensity, I think are ripe for AI disruption. And it's made businesses that are maybe more services heavy or kind of professional services, I think, really interesting kind of initial markets to tackle from an AI perspective.
Welcome to Founders FAQ. Today, my guest is David Hamer. David is a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz, where he focuses on technology investments in financial services. David was previously a senior executive in firm-wide strategy at Goldman Sachs, where he helped lead partnerships, new ventures, and M&A. Before joining the firm, David was a founder and CEO of Bond Street, which aimed to transform small business lending through technology, data, and design. Bond Street was acquired by Goldman Sachs in October 2017. Hey, David. Thank you for coming to Founders FAQ. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Really great to be here.
My first question is, what's your current investment thesis? I'm just wondering, this is my first question.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I mean, maybe to kind of take it from a high level, you know, one of my favorite sayings, which I repeat often, but because I believe it, is that opportunities live between fields of expertise. And I find myself really enjoying kind of exploring those intersections. And it's one of the reasons I've always loved investing in fintech, because in my mind, fintech has sort of become very much a horizontal that kind of cuts across lots of different industries and really kind of a business model that can be, you know, be embedded in all forms of software. So I spent a lot of time, you know, here at Andreessen kind of exploring the intersections of fintech and other industry categories, you know, areas like healthcare, you know, recently renewable energy. I have kind of a gaming and payments investment. And then I've spent a lot of time kind of in what I would call, you know, kind of software businesses that sell into financial services that are solving kind of, you know, complicated workflows and driving efficiencies. You know, the other kind of filter I would say is, you know, I bias towards companies that lead with software or lead with what I would call a network, as opposed to leading with a financial product. And that's a little bit out of, you know, my experience building a fintech company called Bond Street, where the core of that business was a financial product. It was a loan. And I think it's much easier. I'd much rather compete with kind of large incumbent businesses on technology and software, and ideally a business that builds kind of defensibility through a network effect, than, you know, trying to, you know, compete on cost of capital. And so those are kind of like the higher level kind of filters, I would say, that I put on kind of the things that I enjoy. But there, you know, we can get into kind of more subcategories or specific kind of investment theses that we're exploring.
I get it. And in terms of the intersection points, like which categories in fintech have a better growth potential by maybe leveraging AI, or any intersections that you see have any potential?
I think there's a bunch. I mean, I think, well, first of all, I think what you're going to see is that, you know, AI is going to become kind of embedded, you know, everywhere. And, you know, and so I don't know that it's limited to any particular, you know, category. I would say, you know, areas that we're spending time in, and from experience, I feel like AI can drive a lot of efficiencies, are in a lot of kind of back office workflows, again, even in specifically inside of large financial institutions. So, you know, I had previously sold my last company to Goldman. I spent a few years at the firm, and it was just really interesting seeing, you know, what is probably one of the more progressive, you know, large financial institutions in the world. I mean, they have 10,000 engineers, and yet, you know, very large portion of what they call the Federation, which is, you know, kind of the kind of operational back office across the firm, you know, is still living in Excel, let alone kind of enterprise software. And so I think there's a ton of opportunity, again, to kind of embed AI, and kind of a new wave of enterprise software companies are going to become kind of AI native to drive efficiencies across, again, all areas, whether it's legal, risk management, compliance, you know, underwriting, vendor onboarding. Again, I think there's a ton of workflows that are very kind of human capital intensive that have the potential for AI to have a huge impact. And maybe that is kind of a heuristic, you know, areas where, you know, there is a ton of kind of human capital intensity, I think are ripe for AI disruption. And it's made businesses that are maybe more services heavy or kind of professional services, I think really interesting kind of initial markets to tackle from an AI perspective. So, you know, one example that's kind of historically been human capital intensive and also lives at the intersections of fintech and another industry is in the healthcare space. And so I made an investment, for example, in kind of revenue cycle management. And what that means is basically this company has built a bunch of software to submit claims programmatically to all the insurance companies. And so they operate in areas of highly recurring healthcare. So if a patient is seeing a provider, you know, call it 100 times a year, the opportunity to automate a lot of the back office workflows become more significant. And they get paid, call it 3 to 5% to do that, what is called kind of revenue cycle management. Part of that is that they have to deal with denials and kind of claims adjudication, which again, historically, both the submission process was manual and then the adjudication process was basically conversing with humans, you know, to try to sort of fight these denials. You know, they've basically automated all of that and have been leveraging AI to make that whole kind of workflow more efficient for the providers they work with. And as a result, they've taken what was historically, you know, pretty low margin business and brought it to like SaaS-like margins, which I think is, you know, super impressive. And again, not an area people are probably spending a ton of time in, but an area that I think is a huge market and ripe for, you know, for an AI native application.
2021 was, the money was kind of cheap. And what do you think with the current market, like with the current rates and that projection, how is this affecting the fintech companies?
Well, I think it depends on the area of fintech. You know, I take a pretty broad definition, as I sort of described earlier, of what I consider fintech. I think if you were or are a fintech company that is financial product led, you know, meaning the core of your product is a loan or an insurance product or a real estate transaction or a card of some flavor, rates have a much bigger impact, most likely, on your unit economics because they affect your cost of capital, either directly or indirectly by, you know, your warehouse provider or your kind of capacity provider from an insurance perspective. And so what that does is it both kind of shrinks, you know, in some cases, the, you know, the margin because your costs go up, but it also potentially puts a ceiling on demand because in order to kind of, you know, maintain that margin, some people adjust prices by just basically increasing, you know, rates. And there are usury caps that exist in the country. And then also when you increase rates too much, there is some price elasticity. So people, you know, lower their demand, right? Or don't have an appetite for an 8% mortgage, you know, like they did for a 2% one. And so I think that's ultimately had a big impact on the velocity of capital and the growth of balance sheet intensive fintech companies. Conversely, I think there is a whole ecosystem of fintech companies that actually have benefited from both either volatility in rates or rising rates, you know, that maybe aren't lending specific, but, you know, have focused on fixed income, for example. You know, I have another company that has built infrastructure to make it really easy to embed fixed income investments, you know, into any application. And they built basically an API that sits across all the different bond trading menus. Well, it turns out like, you know, bonds weren't that sexy for the last like decade, but you know, if you can get, you know, 5+% yields risk-free, that all of a sudden becomes really attractive relative to other places that you can put capital in. You know, they're really kind of democratizing access to things like, you know, treasuries, municipal bonds, corporate debt, you know, bringing a lot of the kind of technology innovation that has existed in equities, you know, to this kind of long-standing asset class, but one that wasn't necessarily, you know, being leveraged that much by retail or kind of the wealth ecosystem. You know, similarly, we've spent a lot of time kind of focused on software companies that can help regional and community banks kind of run their businesses more efficiently. I think in the wake of SVB, you know, you saw obviously a ton of pressure on kind of the regional and community banking ecosystem with rising rates. You know, some failed, like First Republic and Signature. And the result was that, you know, a lot of deposits flowed into the largest banks. Some flowed, you know, to our portfolio companies or other kind of fintech companies that, you know, allow you to open accounts more efficiently. But I think it would be a bad outcome if the banking ecosystem, which is one of the most kind of decentralized in the world, you know, with thousands of banks across the country, ultimately consolidated into the largest, you know, call it 4 to 5, you know, G-SIBs, right? Kind of systemically important banks. And instead, I think what we are looking for and have begun investing in are companies that can help these community and regional banks kind of manage their balance sheets and compete more effectively. And so we have one company, you know, specifically that has helped, that is working with community regional banks who need to manage their deposit base, you know, a lot more dynamically, again, even in this kind of more volatile rate environment. And they basically connect banks with excess liquidity with those that need liquidity and effectively operate a marketplace in between. And then the second thing that they do is they help increase the amount of FDIC coverage in a reciprocal deposit network. So if you're a large corporate or let's say a super, you know, high net worth, you know, private wealth client, you don't want to be limited to $250,000 in FDIC coverage, right? And if you're a big company, you may want $100 million of FDIC coverage if you have a big balance. And what they do is basically allow that bank to sweep those deposits into their network of, you know, dozens of other banks and, you know, increase FDIC coverage by orders of magnitude. And I think had that existed in banks, you know, this is a hypothetical, but in, you know, things like SVB or First Republic, people may have been less scared to have to pull capital so aggressively if they knew that their uninsured balances, which were the vast majority, were in this sweep network and they had, you know, $100 million of FDIC coverage. And so who knows if that could have prevented, you know, these bank runs, but I think that kind of tool will become increasingly important for that ecosystem. And I think it's a good thing, you know, for the country and for our economy, because at the end of the day, you know, these community and regional banks are really pillars of these kind of local ecosystems and are, you know, some of the largest credit providers to small businesses and local real estate developers. And so I think we need to kind of continue to support the vibrancy of our smaller bank ecosystem in America.
I get it. And I just want to come to the most wanted question. So founders on the investment side, before making an investment decision, what's your pattern recognition? Like what do you look for most in founders, most in markets? Like, because founders always wondering the pattern recognition of the investors, and you were in the both side of the table, but right now as a VC, what's it on your end?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I would say there's like a bunch of qualitative stuff that we look for on the founder side, and it's hard to totally define, you know, but I'd say a few things. One is, how deeply has this founder thought about the problem space that they're tackling? We have different ways that we like to describe this. One is, you know, have they gone through the what we would call the idea maze, right? Like, have they sort of extrapolated all the potential paths and pitfalls and, you know, avenues of success that they could take to build, you know, a significant business here? And I think the related aspect of that exercise is they have an encyclopedic knowledge of the domain that they're going after and of all kind of prior attempts of entrepreneurs who have tackled a similar problem. You know, I like the sort of humble confidence of somebody that in some ways has reverence for people that have tried tackling a similar problem and aren't like totally dismissive of that, right? They're not saying, you know, screw all those people. Like they had no idea what they were talking about. Like we're the only people that understand this space. We're going to do it much better. Instead, it might say like, listen, here's specifically with precision, the reason X, Y, and Z company failed and what our unique insight is and why ultimately, you know, we're going to succeed. And I think the moment you start having that conversation with a founder, it's pretty easy to dissect, you know, who has actually thought deeply about this. Are they even aware of their past competitors? You know, again, how deep is their knowledge of a space? So there's some sense for that. I think the related aspect is, you know, is there a sort of founder market or founder company fit, right? Is this team uniquely qualified given their prior experience, given their perspective or kind of an earned secret to tackle this business in particular, right? Sometimes you have great founders who've had awesome backgrounds, but they're tackling a market that doesn't make sense for them. And so I think we look for kind of founder company fit. And that's certainly how I thought about, you know, why I was the right person to go build the company that I did, you know, previously with Bond Street. Markets are harder. I would say we often ask the question, you know, why now, right? What are the conditions that make today, you know, the right time to build this business? And not just could this market exist, but ultimately a startup is one that needs to grow very quickly. And so what are the catalysts that are actually going to drive, you know, growth or kind of velocity, you know, in this space? And sometimes those are catalyzed by new technologies or new platform shifts. Sometimes they're catalyzed by regulation. But again, often there's sort of the why now. What is possible today that wasn't possible, you know, 2 years ago? I would say the last thing, and I think a lot of people get this wrong in fintech, a lot of investors, in my opinion, I think people are head faked by TAM. Lots of areas of financial services are very, very, very large markets. I think large markets are dangerous. I think people often say, wow, if I only got 1% of all consumer lending, you know, we would build a multi-billion dollar business. And that's true, but almost definitionally, a large market means that it's probably a lot more competitive and a lot more static, right? It's growing very quickly. And so I really like, I think it was Henry Ward from Carta who had this line, which is, I'd much rather be an N of one company than of one of N company, which basically means I'd rather be a monopolist, you know, or, you know, close to a monopolist, let's say, in a small but very fast growing market than one of many competitors in a really large but more static market. And so again, all of those kind of heuristics, you know, kind of come together, and then there's sort of some sort of taste around theme and market and timing. But when those things kind of converge, that ultimately is what gets us to conviction and makes it really easy to, you know, kind of pull the trigger.
Like in the early days, having a top-notch team is pretty important. And at Bond Street, like how did you gather the founding team, and like how did you attract A-plus people in the very early days? And like what do you suggest for founders about having an E-team in the early?
Totally. Well, first it started with my co-founder. You know, I'd known Peyton Sherwood since 2009 when I first moved to New York. He was at D.E. Shaw at the time. And back then, a few years older than me in college, had studied computer science. We actually didn't overlap at school, but we met, you know, through mutual friends here in New York. And I always thought he was brilliant. We kind of hit it off and brainstorming kind of business ideas, you know, never ultimately pursued them back then, but kind of stayed in touch. And he ended up going to run engineering at Venmo. They ended up getting acquired by Braintree and PayPal. And I was at Spark. The why now, by the way, for Bond Street was that a lot of the data that we thought we would need to understand the sort of financial health of these companies was becoming available online via API. So Intuit, QuickBooks, Xero, you know, we had just seeded Plaid. There's a bunch of companies that just started sort of opening up so you could write, again, API integrations to get access to this data. And I thought he uniquely was sort of qualified to help build something because he was the head of engineering at Venmo and they were integrating Plaid as Plaid's first customer. So we both kind of had the right backgrounds to go pursue this business. You know, the very first person we hired, I think in many ways set the culture of the company. And you know, by the way, the thing that I'm most proud of by far with Bond Street was that we recruited an exceptional team. I genuinely believe that. And Jerry was a great example of this. Jerry was the head of small business risk at Citibank. He had been underwriting, you know, I suspect small business loans at that point longer than I'd been alive. I think he was 57 when he joined us. I was 25 when we started the company. And he joined us in my apartment before we had payroll set up, you know, and so I think it to me, it spoke to a few different things. One was his personality was such that he had that sort of sense of humble confidence. He didn't come to the company and say, ah, you freaking kids, like, you don't know what the hell you're doing. You know, at the same time, he, you know, understood the value that he was going to deliver to the company because we were building a small business lending company and we had never underwritten small business loans and he had done that for 30 years or whatever. But I think, again, that sort of tone, that sort of humility set the culture for the types of people that we look for. And I think the other thing is like going after somebody who you think is like the perfect person for a role is really important. I think sometimes founders, and I felt this, you just have like 100 things you need to get done, right? You're just almost overwhelmed by the amount of work to get done. And there is this pull to want to just throw bodies at the problem. You're just like, oh my God, I need help like now. I think it's really important to have some tension in that decision and restraint and kind of keep the bar really high, especially, I mean, I think always, but I think especially critical in the early days of building a company because it pays huge dividends. If you like, the culture is going to be set by the first, you know, 10 people in the business, and you need to keep that bar high such that other A-plus people are going to want to come work for those folks. And so Jerry set that bar high. One of the other amazing folks that had a huge contribution to the company was a guy named Eddie Serrell. Eddie, you know, in a small world, had worked actually for my partner here, Alex Rampell, at his last company, TrialPay. And Eddie ultimately joined us initially actually in a BD capacity, but became our COO. And he was just amazing. I mean, he's probably one of the most more talented operators I've worked with. He just pulled in tons of the organization into his orbit, which were not even in his job description initially. Like he ended up running finance and HR and managing the kind of sales organization and customer success team. And I mean, he was doing the job of the COO, like, you know, probably for a year before, you know, he actually had that title. But he ultimately like was an incredible manager. Other people really liked working for him. He did an amazing job holding them accountable and kind of getting the best out of folks. And again, I think people like that set the culture, you know, for your company. And we tried to do that across every role. you know? And the other quality that I think we look for, and I use that here as well, is this sense for what I would call safe hands, right? The best feeling as a founder is you want to be able to give somebody project or a task, and you know that it's going to get done with quality on time. You don't have to micromanage them. They're just super self-motivated. They're great communicators. They'll reach out if they have questions or need help. And especially if you're a small but fast-growing company, you don't have time to micromanage people. And so you want like a whole group of safe hands. And I think that quality, again, exists at the most junior levels of an organization and at the most senior levels. You know, we had a young guy on our team named Jeremy Roosh, who, you know, I think joined us like a year out of college. He went to Duke. He'd worked at GIC. I don't even know what his initial title was, but he was kind of doing everything. Like he wrote blog posts, he built our sales organization, and he was so good, we just kept pouring responsibility on him, you know? And I think that's really one of the fun things as a founder is just to like, once you find somebody with what I would call, again, safe hands, you just kind of keep pouring and pouring responsibility on them until they, you know, and help them grow. And that's, again, a quality that I think exists and we look for here too. And, you know, I'm fortunate to have Mark Andrusko, who I work closely with, you know, on my team. And I always point to him as a great example of safe hands here at Andreessen.
What you say is pretty important. And on the first hiring and setting the bar high is pretty important because most of the founders want to release their product very fast and getting the market fit fast. But on the first hire, they may miss it. But yeah, you pointed out a really important abiding. My other question is how to build the compounding advantage or unfair advantage in the really, really early days while building the product?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I think you kind of have to ask yourself, like, what are my unique skill sets or my network or my perspective? So I think there's a number of ways to kind of go about that. And, you know, I think it takes a village to build a successful company. So one is, you know, do I have a go-to-market advantage in my network? Or what are my skill sets? Do I have kind of the, like selling into small businesses is a bit of a grind, right? So am I good at kind of high velocity outbound sales? Am I going to manage a team, you know, very directly? Or is my product and business more oriented around, you know, a very consultative kind of enterprise sale, you know, and do I have a network with kind of decision makers inside of big companies who could potentially give me budget or where I could kind of identify problems and I can build a product, you know, to tackle those problems? Ideally, over time, especially, you know, you want that source of compounding competitive advantage to reside in the product, right? In the technology that you're building. And that also can manifest in different ways. You know, you can build a business that becomes, I don't know, the system of record, you know, for a company where, you know, the most kind of sensitive or kind of key, you know, business information lives within your product. And if that product were to go away, you know, the business basically couldn't function. And so you have like significant lock-in and you're also delivering a lot of value. The other qualities could be, I don't know, you know, you could have a potential network effect where, you know, the more customers or nodes kind of in the product, the more powerful and kind of beneficial the product becomes for everybody in that system. And, you know, I like businesses like that because they have that source of compounding advantage and they become sort of this flywheel. It's really hard to get kind of the cold start, you know, going, but once you do, it's a really defensible, you know, company. A similar kind of moat, you know, and it's hard, maybe even harder to find is our businesses that can become platforms. I'd mentioned Plaid, which, you know, I was fortunate enough to help seed at when I was at Spark. Plaid ultimately became very much kind of the platform for this emergent fintech ecosystem. You know, they did the hard work of kind of building an API that sat across all these different banks. And so if you were a net new fintech company, you didn't want to integrate with 5,000 banks. You want to integrate with Plaid because they could give you access to that whole ecosystem. And thousands and tens of thousands of companies built their products that wouldn't have been able to exist if, you know, if Plaid had not existed. And so that ultimately is like, in my mind, one of the core definitions of a platform. So again, it might start initially with kind of your background, your insight, your product, your network, but then over time, it really needs to reside in the technology and, you know, in the value you're delivering to your customers.
When you are in a company board, like what do you expect from the founder, CEO to leverage the board members or you effectively and more?
It's a good question. I mean, I think, look, I try to earn the trust of the entrepreneur, right? I think my role is, at the end of the day, we're very aligned. We're going to be successful if the entrepreneur is successful. And so I want to build that kind of dialogue and transparency with the entrepreneur that they feel comfortable coming to me with hard problems, big or small. I think it's important to be sort of a steady hand in some ways, not kind of overreact to the upside or to the downside when inevitably, you know, shit hits the fan as it always does. And I think, you know, again, having the experience of being a founder before gives me a lot more empathy, you know, for the, you know, really challenging journey that an entrepreneur, that every entrepreneur goes through. So part of it's just being there for them when they need a sounding board and somebody to kind of strategize with. I think a lot of my role and what's really fun here at Andreessen is really to also help kind of marshal the resources of the broader organization. You know, Andreessen looks very different from most venture capital firms. We have 550 people at the organization today. You know, call it 400 plus of those folks, you know, and my partners are operating partners, not investors. And so across lots of different kind of functional areas of expertise, whether it's marketing or go-to-market or people practices or capital markets, we have kind of this whole war machine. And what's amazing about that is, you know, I may have had some hard-earned experience from my time at Bond Street, but I don't know everything, right? Like, I don't know how to run a 1,000-person people organization at a public company, but like Don Knott, who runs people practices on our team, like does, right? I've never negotiated like a multi-billion-dollar M&A transactions, but like Melissa Wasser on our team has, right? I've never run large marketing campaigns or kind of led comms for many companies, but like Melanie has. And so I think that's kind of the amazing thing is that I get to pull in kind of experts in all these different areas for the benefit of the founders we work with. And I, you know, we don't push that on people, but I want to make sure that the entrepreneur recognizes that those, you know, folks and resources exist and they should feel comfortable, you know, leveraging the full weight of the firm to win.
Another like most wanted question is the exit. Do you think like for the exit, founders should have something on their mind in the very early days? What should be the mindset here that you think is ideal?
Look, I think it's like unrealistic to say like a founder is never going to think about an exit and like, you know, and in fact, I think that's unwise. Like I actually think it is smart to have a perspective of like, you know, who would the ecosystem of natural acquirers be for this business if we succeed, right? And I think there is some, you know, small fraction of a founder's time, call it sub 10%, that should be spent with the ecosystem of potential acquirers. And I give the same advice even for fundraising, right? Like at the end of the day, you're going to build a company by executing and operating and building the product and the business and the go-to-market. Not going to build a business purely based on fundraising. But you should still run some background process and get to know people and kind of educate the market and build relationships with people who could invest in your company in the future. And I think the same is true for that ecosystem of people who could buy your company because, you know, and I think it was Mark Suster, I forget, but there was a good line that says, you know, people like to invest in lines, not dots. Dots being sort of a static point in time, a line being a relationship that is built over a period of time. And that is very true in M&A. After selling Bond Street, I sat in a corp dev seat. So I was evaluating potential M&A. And I will tell you, when a company comes to you saying, okay, you need to buy us, we're for sale, and you have to make a decision in 2 weeks, like the likelihood of that transaction happening is very, very low. The much more likely scenario is you've been meeting with that key decision maker for the last 3 years. They've seen your progress and how you've executed. They've recognized within their own organization that your business or your product is a small piece of a much bigger opportunity that they already have agreed that they want to go execute against. And they would view acquiring your company as basically a way to accelerate, you know, that outcome. Then when you approach them and say, hey, by the way, we got M&A interest from somebody else. I wanted to give you a look. There's goodwill. There's a relationship. There's that line, not the dot. And that has a huge impact on the potential outcome and scale of outcome of an M&A transaction.
And lastly, do you have any message for the audience and mostly for fintech founders?
No, I would say, look, stick at it. Like, you know, I know fintech, you know, goes in waves. I've seen lots of different cycles since 2011, investing and building and operating in the fintech landscape. You know, fintech has not been without its challenges the past couple of years. But I think it's important to recognize that, you know, financial services is one of the biggest parts of our global economy. There's massive numbers of problems that have yet to be solved. And so we're really optimistic. You know, we're here, we're open for business. We love fintech and really excited again to see, you know, more people kind of embracing AI and leveraging it kind of natively into the products that they're building. And yeah, really curious and excited to see all the kind of exciting and new, you know, customer experiences and kind of workflows that can be solved with this kind of emerging technology. So if you're building, you know, something interesting and really ambitious in fintech, we'd love to chat.
Great. David, it's really nice to have you at Founders of AQ. Thank you for coming.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
By the way, you can order Founders FAQ from foundersfaq.com. It covers the answers to all the possible questions of a founder in a startup journey, revealing life-saving principles for the startup survival path, building A-plus teams, creating an evolving machine, setting up an EAT culture, or interpreting the true path for the fundraising.